each. Okay, so let's start. We're going to start talking about, let me just remind you what we started with. We started with, in our first session of this course, we started talking about Megillat Esther and the Midrashic sources in Megillat Esther that point to the special qualities of the Megillat and the fact that it is difficult because it has a text and a subtext, right? There's the sort of the surface of the text, which is accessible to every reader. And then there are all sorts of clues and cues in the text that are accessible to only the Jewish reader, only the informed reader. Okay, that in itself is an interesting topic, but we're not gonna go further into that. Last week, we talked about the will to power in Ahasuerus. And we said that the first parak and a half, and in fact, this theme runs through the whole book, are an expression of the relationships between the non-Jewish principles in this story, the non-Jewish personalities in this story, are relationships that are power-based and that we are going to see as we go further are a reflection of a pagan worldview. The fact that there is no trust, there is no mutuality, there is no loyalty manifested in these relationships, that the king's will to power, Ahasuerus's will to power, his desire to be the most powerful person in the world, is disastrous on many, many levels for the society as a whole, and that doesn't seem to be a concern of his. All of this is a reflection of the worldview of the pagan world. And we're going to see how that works. Here in our next section, which I'm opening the source here, and I received a request from somebody to sort of indicate where I'm reading. I will do my best, but I'm not exactly Mrs., like I said, Miss Little Miss Technology here. So I hope that it will be possible to do this okay. We are now looking at, oh, look, it works. There's a little red thing there. Okay, we're now looking at Esther Perek Bet, and what we are going to be examining here, is the relationship between Mordechai and Esther, which is obviously central to the story. And to understand the relationship, we have to start in Perek Bet because that is the introduction of Mordechai. Remember the context, though. Mordechai is introduced after the description of how the women are going to be brought by force to the king's palace to be used in this massive ego-stroking exercise that Ahasuerus has organized to get himself a queen to replace Vashti. Okay, so here we are, ladies and gentlemen. Let's take a look at it. Ish Yehudi haya b'Shushan habira. There was a Jewish man in Shushan, the capital. Shmo Mordechai ben Yair ben Shim'i ben Kish. And his name was Mordechai, the son of Ya'il, the son of Shim'i, the son of Kish, Ish Yemini, a Benjaminite man. Yemini means from the tribe of Binyamin, a Benjaminite. Now, right away, when we start to look at these words, Ish Yehudi and Ish Yemini, we sense the first problem or the first indication of the powerlessness of the Jewish principles in this story. The Jewish people become Jews, Yehudi, Judeans, only in exile. In Eretz Yisrael, on their own land, each person was a member of a tribe. And he was first and foremost a Ben Yisrael, and then he was a Yehudi, or a Binyamini, or Yemini, or an Ash, Naphtali. Whatever tribe he was from, his tribal identity was paramount. And there are some interesting midrashim on this pasuk, which we're not going to be looking at because they don't relate directly to this question of the powerlessness of Mordechai. But the fact that Mordechai is lumped in as a Judean man, he's a Jew, even though he's a Yemini, is an indication that the categories and the names and the identifications of Jews in Galut are going to be different than they are in Eretz Yisrael, in the land of Israel, on your home turf. Okay, let's take a look at this now. Here we are in Pasuk Vav. Asher hoglam Yerushalayim, he was exiled from Yerushalayim. Im hagola asher hogleta im Yechaniah haMelech Yehuda, with the exile that was exiled with Yechaniah the king of Yehuda, asher hegla Nebuchadnezzar Melech Babel, whom Nebuchadnezzar the king of Babel had exiled. Okay, here it's obvious. The word that is being, the key word that is being sort of hammered home over and over and over again is the word exile. Hogla, gola, hogleta, hegla. It keeps being repeated. The text is hammering home. Mordechai has the status of a refugee, somebody who's been exiled, somebody who has no power in this land. He has no rights. He has no, if you will, he has no position as a citizen in this place. Okay. Vayhi omenet hadasa, he Esther batodo, and he was, he had adopted, or he was taking care of Hadassah, who is Esther, his cousin, the son of his uncle, daughter of his uncle, I'm sorry, he en la avaim, because she had no father or mother. And the girl was beautiful of form and good of appearance. And at the death of her father and her mother, Mordechai took her to himself as a daughter. We're going to see down here what Masechet Megillah has to say about this. We're going to read that in a minute. But right away, let me just point out something here. First of all, we have the phenomenon of two names. Hadassah, who is Esther. Okay? Now, if you are an Asian American, right? Or if you're a Jewish American, it goes by your Jewish name or Hebrew name, you will be familiar with this phenomenon, the phenomenon of the double name. There's the name that everybody calls you at home, and there's the name that everybody calls you at school, at work, in public, right? My name is Simi. I cannot tell you how often at college I was called Cindy, because Simi is not a name that Americans are familiar with or used to, okay? There was an Asian American young woman in my class whose name was Susie. I am fairly certain that at home they did not call her Susie. So we have Hadassah, who is Estelle. That's right, she's got two names. And she is an orphan, and Mordechai has adopted her. Okay, let's take a look for a moment at what the Gemara says here, Masechet Megillah, and we'll go back to the Psukim verses in a minute, on the words, Asher Heglam Yerushalayim, who was exiled from Jerusalem. The Gemara says, Amar Rava, Shegala me'atzmo. Rava says he was exiled by himself, meaning Mordechai, who could have presumably stayed in Eretz Yisrael, there were Jews who stayed in the land of Israel, exiled himself, took himself away to join the other exiles who were outside of Eretz Yisrael, presumably because he assumed that that was his proper job. He sees himself as the custodian, the leader, the helper of the community in exile. And then the Midrash says the following. Vayhi omen et Hadassah, and he had adopted, he was taking care of Hadassah. Kari la Hadassah, the text calls her Hadassah. Vikari la Estel, and it calls her Estel. How do we get these two names? Tanya Rabbi Meir Omer. We learn, Rabbi Meir says, Estel Shma, her name was Estel. Velama nikra Shma Hadassah. And why was her name called Hadassah? Al Shem HaTzadikim, on the name of the Tzadikim, Shenikru Hadassim, who are called myrtles. Now, the word Hadassah means a myrtle bush or myrtle tree. And she is called, her real name, according to Rabbi Meir, is Estel. And her nickname was Hadassah because she's a little Tzadika, right? She's a righteous woman, and tzadikim are called hadassim. V'chein hu omer, and the, as in Zechariah, the text says, v'hu omed ben ha-hadassim. In Zechariah, he identifies an angel that is speaking to him in his vision, who is standing among the myrtles, symbolically among the righteous. Rabbi Yehuda omer hadasa shma. Rabbi Yehuda says her name was Hadasa. Belama nikret shma Esther. And why was her name called Esther? Al shem shahita misateret dvareha. Because she would hide her words. Shenehemar ein Esther magedet et ama. And the rest of the verses be'et moladeta. Esther, as it is said, Esther would not tell her people or her birthplace. Rabbi Nechemia Omer, or Rabbi Nechemia says, Hadassah Shma, her name was Hadassah, the Hebrew name, Velama Nikret Estel, and why was she called Estel? Shahayu Umot Olam Kaurin Ota Al Shem Istahav. The nations of the world, the non-Jews in the Persian kingdom, would call her this on the name of Istahav, who was a Persian goddess. Okay, so what we have here is all sorts of small but very telling indications, the repetition of the word exile, the fact that Esther has two names, which in a sense means she has two identities. And Mordechai, by the way, does not. The Talmud discusses what his real name was, because Mordechai was his Persian name. His real name is sort of hidden. And then the Gemara goes on. We skipped a couple of lines. Ki ein la av va'em, because she had, Mordechai adopted her because she had no father or mother. Uvimo daviha be'ima la'mali. Why, if you told me that she had no father or mother, do you have to tell me that at the death of her father and Mordechai, of father and mother, Mordechai took her to him, adopted her, took her to him. Amar Rav Acha. Rav Acha said, Ibalta meit aviha. When her mother became pregnant, her father died. Yilidita meita ima. When her mother gave birth to her, her mother died. Uvimot aviha viima litacha Mordechai lo lebat. And at the death of her father and her mother, Mordechai took her to himself as a daughter. Tana mishum Rabbi Meir. We learn according to Rabbi Meir. Al tikre lebat. Do not call her daughter. Ella lebayit, but rather household. Meaning, what has the Gemara just told us? And I'll stop the share here for a minute, just so I can see if you're, you know, following. The Gemara has just told us that Mordechai, in fact, married Esther. Okay, that Esther was his wife as well as his adopted daughter. Now, though this may not seem obvious on a first reading, this is also an indication of Mordechai's powerlessness, of Estelle's powerlessness, the fact that they have no power, no control. What would have happened in Eretz Yisrael, in the tribal structure of Binyamin, had Esther's, Hadassah's parents both died? Well, it would not have been the case that a single man would have had to adopt this baby. Right? In other words, if you're talking about a tribal structure, you're talking about an extended family structure, and there is nobody within a tribal structure who does not have a relative somewhere within the tribe, right? Either by, you know, even in the case of a convert to Judaism, if they marry somebody within the tribe of Binyamin, their children are going to have relatives within the tribe of Binyamin. It would never have been the case had Mordechai not been part of an expatriate community, if he had been on his home ground, that he would have had to adopt Esther. And under normal circumstances, there would have been a cousin, an aunt, an uncle, there would have been relatives who would have taken this child into their home. But also, in the context of the Persian Empire, the only way that Mordechai can adopt and have rights or ownership of this girl baby is to marry her, right? Because the ordinary structures that would give family a right to adopt and take care of a child who had been abandoned would not, the ordinary structures would not, would not have made it necessary for him to adopt her. And there would have been no presumption that she would be taken away from him if she was not married to him. And I have to tell you here a very interesting story Of course, many, many centuries later, my son had a friend in yeshiva, a boy from a Persian background, whose great great grandmother was left orphaned by a plague in Persia. And she was a 7-year-old girl, and the authorities were going to take her away from the Jewish community and marry her off to a Muslim man, or to put her up for adoption with a Muslim family. And the heads of the Jewish community in that place went to a young man who was two, she was 7 years old. They went to a young man who was 20 years old, and they said he couldn't afford to marry. He was very poor. And they said, "We will pay you. We will marry you off. We will support you if you marry this girl, and we will provide you with the ability to take care of her, marry her, so that they will not take this child away." And that's what he did. And apparently, from the age of 7 to the age of 14, he carried her on his back to the field, sat her under a tree where she hung out while he worked, married her when she was old enough to be married, younger, perhaps much younger than we would assume would be an appropriate age for marriage. And apparently, they proceeded to have a fine family of fine Jewish children. And one of their great great grandchildren was a Bachur Yeshiva, a yeshiva student in Jerusalem in my son's class. And the family legend was that this woman wore the pants in the family. She was this powerhouse of a woman who ran the whole. She was the matriarch of the family and ran things with a strong arm. Okay. In any event, what you have here is this unnaturally created situation between Mordechai and Esther is a function of the fact that they are refugees. They are not on their home ground. They are not within the social structure that would enable them to have the life that they would have had in their own home. Now, if we think about issues of power, if we think about the problem of power in a relationship, and this is something, of course, that we have to think about. There is no social worker on the planet today who would have permitted a man to become both father, mother, husband, rabbi, and spiritual leader for a young girl, right? No, I mean, no, and rightly so, right? You might think that the power differential here would be impossible, right? Esther is so much down here, and Mordechai is so much up here. He's everything, right? He's, as I said, father, mother, husband, rabbi, spiritual leader, head of the community, everything. And Esther is down here. That's the expectation. And here we really do have to think about issues of power in connection with the relationships we see earlier in the story between all of the non-Jewish main characters. Okay, so we're gonna have to come back to this. What I'd like to do now is go back to the verses and continue reading.
Can I ask a
Okay,
question?
you can, but fast. Yeah.
Okay. When it says that Mordechai galame atzmo, could that be that he was exiled from himself, and that's why we
No,
only
no, no.
hear
It's
from him?
not a. It's not a. It's not a poetic statement.
Okay.
Egla me'atzmo means he of his own volition went into exile. Okay. It's not poetic, metaphorical, pretty, no. just a fact about this. Okay. Okay, so here's the now we're back at the verses that we were reading. And here again, of course, is the most obvious indication of powerlessness. Hang on. See, okay. Spotlight. Sorry. I'm not so good at this. Here we are. Okay. And it was when the word of the king was heard and his law. And in the gathering of many girls, young women, to Shushan, the capital, to the hand of Hegai, who was the harem master. Vatilakach Esther Beit HaMelech Eliad Hegai Shomer HaNashim. Esther was taken to the house of the king, to the hand of Hegai, the guardian of the women. Right, the paramaster. Now here, this is very, very clear. And in this, perhaps Mordechai is not more powerless than anyone else in the Persian Empire, despite the fact that he is married to this woman, despite the fact that he is her adoptive parent, he cannot prevent Esther from being taken. Vatilapach Estel, like all the other women whom the king's bounty hunters go after, Estelle is taken, and he has no way to protect her. Let's go on. And the girl found favor in the eyes of the harem master. She carried grace or kindness before him. And he hastened her cosmetics and her portions to give her. And the seven servants who were fitting to give her from the house of the king. This is a major, expensive, wasteful operation. Each candidate for the king's favor, each candidate for the position of queen, because she might end up being queen, has seven maidservants, right, watching her, which just, you know, it's just mind-boggling. And Hegai, who is the harem master, changed her place and that of her servants to the better part of the women's of the harem. And this is super important. Lo higida Esther et dama ve'et moladita. Esther did not tell her people or her birthplace. Ki Mordechai tziva aleha asher lo tagid. Because Mordechai commanded her not to say where she was from, who she was. And here again is another indication of the fact that this is the defense of the weak. Mordechai commands, and this is a troubling verb in light of the relationship between Mordechai and Esther, as we have seen it up until this point. Mordechai commands her not to reveal who she is. Why does he do this? Presumably because he's trying to protect her. Mordechai understands that he will not be able to protect her in the palace, right? It's a hostile environment. It's a multicultural society. The Jews are low man on the totem pole. Keep your head down, Esther. Do not tell anybody who you are. Anonymity, and we will see this as a motif that recurs in the, not just in the Esther story, but in other sort of descriptions of, well, we'll see, but anonymity is the defense of the weak. The best thing you can do is keep a low profile. However, on each and every day, Mordechai would be walking before the courtyard of the harem, to know how Esther was and what would be done with her. Presumably, like many other relatives of women who had been forcibly taken to the harem, Mordechai is standing outside the harem, and when he sees a servant come out, or an official, or a guard, or something, he bribes them to find out, have you seen what has happened to Hadassah? Have you seen what has happened to Estelle? He presumably is trying to protect her, perhaps maybe to send her messages, to find a way to hear how she is. Again, the position of a weak person. Okay. Here Esther Rabba says something, the Midrash in Esther Rabba says something I think quite interesting and important. When Esther is taken to the palace, the Midrash points out or understands this in the following way. Zeh echad mi'arba'at tzadikim shenitan lahem remes. Mordechai was one of four righteous men who was given a foreshadowing, a hint from heaven, right? In other words, a remez, a sign, a hint from God that something's coming down. Shnayim chashu u'shnayim lo chashu. Two of the people, two of the righteous men who were given a sign from heaven felt it, you know, sensed it, paid attention to it, and two of them did not. Moshe nitan lo remez velo chash. Moshe was given a hint and he did not feel it. He did not pick it up. Yaakov nitan lo remez velo chash. Yaakov was given a hint or an allusion, and he did not pick it up. As you can see from the ellipsis here, I have cut out those two examples, but I will say, broadly speaking, Moshe and Yaakov's hints, or the foreshadowing from heaven that was given to them, both involved their personal destiny, not the destiny of the Jewish people, which may be why they didn't pick up the hint. Okay. Aval David u Mordechai nitan lahem remez v'chashu. David and Mordechai were given a hint and they picked it up. They felt it. They sensed it. David amal, David said, gam et ari gam hadov hita avdecha. This is taken from the story of David's fight with Goliath, with Goliath. When he's trying to explain to King Saul why he's not afraid to Melech Shaul, why he's not afraid to fight Goliath, right, Goliath, he says, as a shepherd, it was given to me, or twice, I killed a lion and a bear, right? And then he goes on to say, since I was able to kill the lion and the bear, I will be able to kill the Philistine. Amar David. So David said, how am I important or precious that I struck these wild animals? Ella amar, but rather, he said to himself, Shema davar, sorry, I'm losing my, Shema davar atid leira et Israel, perhaps something in the future will happen with Israel, with Israel, v'hein atidin linatzel al yadi, and in the future they will be saved by my hand. In other words, David, experiencing the miracle of being able to kill a lion and later a bear with his bare hands, says to himself, God is sending me a signal. There's something here he's telling me. I need to know that I have special power that I will be able to exercise in the service of Israel. Mordechai, what was Mordechai's example? L'chol yom v'yom, Mordechai mitalech lifnei chatzar beit hanashim. Every single day, Mordechai would walk in front of the courtyard of the harem. Why did he do that? Amal, he said. Eshar litzadek et zo shetinaseh le'arel. Can it be that this righteous woman will be forcibly married to an uncircumcised man? That's crazy. Even statistically, if you think about it, it's totally crazy. How could it be that Davka, this righteous woman, and remember, Mordechai knows exactly who Esther is. He raised her. He knows her intimately, right? She's going to be married to an uncircumcised male. Ela she'atid davar gadol she'era al Yisrael. But in the future, something big will happen to Israel. And in the future, it will be saved by her hand. Now, whether or not we take this statement literally, he sort of foresees what is awaiting Israel. What is very clear is that Mordechai has a sense of destiny here. In addition to his desire to protect her, to hear what's happening to her, his concern and his worry for her, he senses that if this righteous woman could be placed in this position, something must be going on. That's the way the Midrash reads it. Okay, is that clear? Should we go on? Let's go back to the chair and we'll go back to our texts here. Okay, let's go now to the continuation of chapter 2. Perek Bet, Esther Bet, Tetzayin Chav, here. Okay, we're back in chapter 2. And once again, we have that verb. Hang on. I'm sorry. Let me get my pointer. Vatilakach Esther el ha-melech ha-chashverosh el beit malchuto. And Esther was taken to the king of Chashverosh, to his royal house, to his palace. B'chodesh ha-asiri u'chodesh tevet, in the 10th month, which is Tevet. Bishnat Sheva leMalchuto, in the 7th year of his reign. The story starts in the 3rd year. Esther becomes queen in the 7th year. Vayehav haMelech et Esther mikol anashim. The king loved Esther more than all the women. Vatisachen b'chesed lepanav mikol habtulot. And she found favor and kindness before him, more than all the virgins. Vayasem ketel malchut berosha, and he placed a royal crown on her head. Vayamlichea tachat Vashti, and he made her queen in place of Vashti. Esther Rabbah comments on this, and this is a revealing comment. Esther Rabbah here. ויהב המלך את אסתר מכל הנשים ותיסחן בחסד וגומל, מכל הבתולות. The king loved Esther more than all the women, and she found grace and kindness before him more than all the virgins. The Midrash picks up on the fact that we get two different words for the women that the king is trying out or testing out to decide if they will be queen. Some of them are called women, nashim, and some are called virgins. Rabbi Chelbo amar, Rabbi Chelbo said, melamed she'av ha'nesu'ot hebiu lefanav. This teaches us that even the married women they brought before him, v'chach ne'emar, therefore it is said, mikol ha'nashim u'mikol ha'ptulot, from all the women, meaning married women, and from all the virgins, meaning virginal women. Okay, so he picks Esther. We're back to the text again. Vayas ha-melech mishte gadol l'chol sarai ba'avadav. The king made a big party. This is a major partier, this fellow. Okay, for all of his ministers and servants. Et mishte Esther, the feast of Esther. V'hanacha l'amdinot asa, and he made a tax rebate for the provinces. Vayitein mas et kiyat ha-melech, and he gave gifts like the hands of the king. In other words, to celebrate his marriage to Esther, what does the king do? Parties, he makes a feast for Esther, he makes a tax rebate, he gives gifts. And then we get a very funny pasuk here. Uvihi kavet betulot chenit. And in the second gathering of the virgins, uMordechai yoshev b'shar hamelech. Mordechai was sitting in the gate of the king. Okay, if we're reading carefully, this is what I would call a wait a minute moment, right? We just got ourselves a queen, right? We now have a queen. Why are we gathering the virgins a second time? Like, what? What's going on here? Again, this might be something that slips past the reader who is not reading with the same intensity of, I need to understand every word. But this is certainly a legitimate question. Why are we gathering the virgins a second time? Okay, so let's go back to our to the text once again. En Esther magedet moladita ve'etama. Esther was not telling her birthplace and her people. Kashil tiba aleha Mordechai. There's that verb again. As Mordechai had commanded her. We don't like that verb commanded in this context. Ved ma'amar Mordechai Esther osa. And the word of Mordechai Esther would do. Kashil haita omna ito. Just as when she had been adopted by him. Tractate Megillah, Masechet Megillah tells us the following. Okay. And knits these parts of the text together. Vayas ha-melech mishte gadol. The king made a great feast. Avad mishtaya, he made a feast in Aramaic, okay? V'lo galya, and she did not reveal. V'lo galya le, and she did not reveal to him. What's the Midrash saying here? What is the Gemara saying here? Esther gets married to Ahasuerus. Maybe it's even convenient for him that he does not know who she is, right? Maybe that's even a plus to a certain extent. His first wife was someone he knew fully well who she was, and it wasn't the best thing in the world for him. But he's married a woman who he doesn't know who he is. He's conferring royalty on her. He has decided who's the boss here. And they get married, and the day after the wedding, the king says, so honey, who are you? And what does Esther do? Lo galyale. She didn't reveal it to him. Dali chalga, he gave a rebate, tax rebate. Lo galyale. And she did not reveal it to him. Shadal pardishani, he sent gifts. Lo galyale. and she did not reveal it to him. So we have a sort of interesting situation here. Ahasuerus is trying to flatter or wheedle Esther into revealing to him who she is. And of course, what does the text tell us? Esther's not revealing. Uvihi kavetz betulot chenit, and in the second gathering of the exiles, gathering the exiles for? Azil shakal etzami Mordechai. He went and he took advice from Mordechai. Amal, what did Mordechai say? Ein isha mitkana ela b'yerech chavilta. A woman is jealous only of her friend's thigh, or right? In other words, what's going to provoke her into telling you who she is? If you act like you're going to be taking another wife. And even so, she did not reveal it to him. As it is written, Esther did not reveal her birthplace, her identity. Okay, so we have here a very interesting situation. The king is in a position where he can't figure out who Esther is. And by the way, it could be that in doing this, Mordechai has come up with even better protector than he perhaps anticipated. He also can't kill her, because to kill somebody, you have to know who you're killing. You don't know who you're going to offend. You don't know where you might start a war. You don't know who their power base is, who might take revenge for this. So the king is trying to put pressure on Esther to say who she is. And what happens is that she keeps silent through even the veiled threat, not so veiled perhaps, of the second gathering of the virgins. Okay, so Midrashic sources are knitting together the story and sort of showing how all the pieces add up. Let's go back to the verses. We're going to skip the section about Haman. We'll be coming back to it, Bezrat Hashem, I hope next week, about who Haman is and what the significance of Haman is in the story. But in Perek Dalet, in chapter 4, because chapter 3 is the story of the decree, of Haman's decision to talk the king into destroying all the Jews in his empire. In chapter 4, we're after the decree. And the verses here are extremely, extremely interesting and suggestive. And that's where we're picking up. So again, we're skipping an important chapter 3, which talks about Haman. And now we're talking about the aftermath. Okay, so hang on. Wait a minute. I'm sorry. I seem to have. Oh, here it is. Okay. Mordechai yada et kol asher nasa, and Mordechai knew all that had been done. What is being referred to here is the making of the decree. V'gram Mordechai begadav, and Mordechai tore his garments. V'ilbash sak va'efel, and he put on sackcloth and ashes. Vayetze betoch ha'il, and he went out into the midst of the city. Vayizak za'aka gedola u'mara, and he cried a great and bitter cry. Vayavo ad lifnei shar ha'melech, and he came up to right before the gate of the king. Ki en lavol shar ha'melech belvush sak, because one is not permitted to come into the gate of the king in sackcloth, in a garment of sackcloth. We know this, by the way, from the story of Yosef, right? We know this from the story of Yosef, that even though Paro is desperate to have him come and interpret the dream, we have a verse there right before he comes to the king saying that he has to change his clothing and be barbered before he can come before the king. And in each and every province, place where the word of the king and his law reached, Evel gadol la'yehudim, there was great mourning for the Jews, tzom u'vechi u'misped, and fasting and weeping and eulogizing, sak va'efer yutzal rabim. Sackcloth and ashes were spread out upon many people. Everyone's wearing sackcloth and ashes. V'tavona na'arot Esther v'sariseha, and the maidservants of Esther and her chamberlains came, Ve'agidula, and they told her that Mordechai was wearing sackcloth. Vatitchalchal hamalka ma'od, and the queen became very sick. Avatishlach begadim lahalbishet Mordechai, and she sent clothing to dress Mordechai. Ulahasil sako me'alav, and to remove his sackcloth from upon him. Velo kibel, and he would not receive it. Now, this is extremely strange, if you think about it. What is clear from these four psukim, from these four verses, is that Esther alone, of everybody else in the empire, has no idea what has just happened. And it makes sense. She's not out on the street reading the decrees. She's not watching the runners and the horsemen and the camel drivers rushing out to deliver the decrees that the Jews are going to be killed. She's just a bird in a gilded cage. And she, as we will see it after her conversation with Mordechai, she has no conversation with him. There's nothing going on here, right? And all she hears from her maidservants is that Mordechai is wearing sackcloth and ashes. And what would we expect her to do at this point? We would expect her to ask Mordechai what's going on. That would be the logical thing, right? Mordechai's wearing sackcloth and ashes. Tell me what's going on. What does she do? She sends him clothing. Tell him he has to change his clothing. And he refuses. What's the deal? Okay, so this is, I think, the first introduction of the motif of clothing, which is really, really central to Megillat Esther, right? The idea that, if you think about it, there is only one other biblical story in which clothing really figures in any great degree. And that is the story of Yosef. Absolutely. Yes. The story of Yosef. Yes, we do have description of the making of the clothing of the Kohen Gadol, right, of the Kohanim, and the priest and the high priest, the Kohanim and the Kohen Gadol. But that is prescriptive. That's like a description of the construction of the tabernacle. That's a set of instructions for constructing clothing. But generally speaking, as we have noted before, in Tanakh, the text is, I think we noted this before. If we didn't, we're going to note it now, okay? The Tanakh is not a visual, cinematic kind of text. If you think about the difference, for example, between Western literature and the Tanakh, most novels are cinematic. You get a visual representation. The hero, the heroine, and the actors are described. Please mute yourselves, because I'm hearing myself, and that makes me.
Can
crazy.
I just say something though? With Shaul, you have a lot of clothing.
So wait. Okay, with Shaul, you don't have a lot of clothing. Actually, you
it's have significant. Some, it's significant, and Mordechai is his descendant.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that. So let's go back to what we have here. As I said, the Hebrew Bible is not cinematic. It's not visual. We don't know what people look like. At the most, we know when it is significant, something like she was pretty, he was handsome, right? We also know when somebody has some sort of dramatic and significant visible difference between them and other people. Esav is ruddy, David is ruddy, things like that. But
what about Jacob and Esau?
No, that's right. We have it. We don't really. We only know. Again, it's these kinds of details are mentioned only when they are really significant. And the reason we know they're significant is because otherwise they don't occur, right? We also have I don't want to turn this into a class on the visual details in the Tanakh. But, for example, we know about Prophet Elijah's cloak. We know that he's hairy and that Elisha is bald. But these are mentioned for very, very specific reasons. Otherwise, if you were to describe what does David HaMelech, what does King David look like? You don't know, right? You know that Shaul, King Saul, is tall. He looks like a king. That's an important detail. But generally speaking, clothing does not feature in the Tanakh. The dramatic examples or exceptions to that rule are Megillat Esther, the Book of Esther, okay? And the other dramatic example is Yosef. And in fact, Midrash makes a connection between those two things because the authors of Megillat Esther deliberately allude to the Yosef story in many ways, okay? And I always remember as a, I mean, this is, I don't know if this.
Hannah makes new clothes for Shmuel every year.
Also, yes, but we don't know what the clothing looked like. We don't know what the clothing looked like. What are we, why are being told that Hannah makes a new garment for Shmuel? To tell us that she maintains her connection with her child, that he's wearing the garb that his mother gave him. But it's not, ladies, compare this to any passage in any novel, modern or classic, and you the dearth of cinematic or visual description is striking in Tanakh. It's definitely, that's why whenever there is mention of clothing in Tanakh or a visual detail about how someone looks or how a place looks, which is almost non-existent, we have to pay attention to it. We already noticed that the sort of purple prose in Perek Aleph, the description of the splendor of the palace, is a veiled criticism of the power mongering of Ahasuerus, right? We talked about that. So again, when you have mention of clothing, it is very, very significant. And I remember as a child being very disturbed that in the Ashkenazi tradition, I don't think this is true in all of the Eidot HaMizrach, the Sephardic traditions. But in the Ashkenazi tradition, we read four verses out loud. And one of them, which is at the end of the book, describes what Mordechai is wearing. And of course, the question is, who cares what Mordechai is wearing? Why do we need to know what Mordechai is wearing? So what's very clear from Esther's reaction is that the impulse to change the clothing tells you that for the house of Rachel, and I'm going to make this broad generalization, for the house of Rachel, clothing has symbolic and spiritual significance. Okay? So when Mordechai goes out there and he's wearing sackcloth and ashes, and this is a motif that runs all the way through Midrash. We could probably do a 4-week course just on this topic. When Mordechai goes out there in sackcloth and ashes, what does Esther do? Change your clothing. It will fit. You can't wear that. You have to fix what you're wearing. It will fix the situation. And of course, as Mordechai knows, that is not going to work here. Okay. Now here, what I'd like to do is look with you at the following source, okay? Which is from Bereishit Rabbah, which is Genesis Ramah here. And here is the first of the allusions that we have seen. There are others. Here is the first of the allusions to the significance or the Joseph story relative to Megillat Esther. What do the brothers do? Okay, we know that the Joseph story has a lot of details about clothing. His father gives him a tonic asim, a tunic of stripes or a tunic with long sleeves, different readings of that in the Midrash. And of course, that creates jealousy among the brothers. The brothers rip that clothing off him. They dip it in blood and they send it to their father because they are trying to deceive him into believing that Yosef is dead. And what is Yaakov's reaction? What does Yaakov do? Hang on. Vayikra Yaakov simlotan. Yaakov tore his garments. Rabbi Pinchas b'shem Rabbi Hoshaya amar. Rabbi Pinchas said in the name of Rabbi Hoshaya, Shvatim garmu l'avihem likroa. The tribes, meaning the sons of Jacob, caused their father to tear his garments. Ve'echan nifra lehem, and where were they paid back? V'mitzrayim, in Egypt. Sheneemar, as it is said, Vayikra'u simlotam. They tore their garments. What's this alluding to? When Yosef frames Binyamin, for stealing his goblet, and the brothers are devastated to be stopped and Binyamin taken away from them, what do? They tear their garments. Yosef garam lashvatim likroa. Yosef caused the tribes, his brothers, to tear their garments. Amad ben Benov nifralo. His descendant rose up, and he was paid back for this. Shene emar, as it is said in Yehoshua, in the book of Joshua, Vayikra Yehoshua simlotav. Joshua tore his garments. What's the situation there? The Jewish people have gone out to battle after Yericho. They go to a place called Ha'ai. And at Ha'ai, they are defeated because of a sin committed by someone after the conquest of Yericho. He takes from the forbidden spoils, and people die, and Yehoshua is devastated, and he rends his garment out of concern for the Jewish people. Binyamin garam lashvatim likroa. Benjamin, Binyamin, of course, remember, Mordechai is from the tribe of Binyamin, caused his brothers to tear their garments out of concern for him. Ve'echan nifra lo. And where was he paid back? Shushan habira. In Shushan, the capital, in the Esther story, she'ne'emal, v'yikra Mordechai et begadav. As it is said, Mordechai tore his garments. Now, what the Midrash is saying here is that there is an historical process of action and payback, you know, measure for measure, that has an historical turnover, right? There is the actions of previous personalities, actors in the story, create effects that have implications for later Jewish history. This is part of a larger motif in Midrash generally. The Ramban, Nachmanides, talks about this in great detail, but it's ubiquitous in Midrashic sources, the idea that the actions of the fathers and mothers have consequences for the children. And what we have happening here is, in a sort of roundabout way, Mordechai is rending his garments because of what started with Yosef. What started with the rending of garments by Yaakov for his son Yosef. And I'm going to skip a little bit here, and we're going to go to the next piece. After it says, Yaakov tore his garments, it says, Vayasem sak bimotnav, and he placed sackcloth on his loins. Amar Rabbi Aivu says, Lefisha tafas Yaakov avinu et hasak, because Jacob, our father, grasped the sackcloth. Lefichach eino zaz lo mimenu v'lo mibanav v'lo mibnei banav. Therefore, it will not be removed from him or his children or his children's children ad sof kol hadorot, until the end of all generations. Ve'eino noheg ela mibnei banav dolim. And it only is played out with the great ones of his sons. And it gives examples of Jewish leaders, including Mordechai, who put on sackcloth for the sake of the Jewish people. Mordechai, in the case of Mordechai, what does it say? Vayilbash sak va'efel. And he put on sackcloth and ashes. Okay. Now we're going to return to this motif, but remember that we are also talking about the relationship between Mordechai and Esther, okay? We'll continue with that. I want to give you some time for questions. The subsequent here, in the continuing of this story, where Esther says, change your clothing and you have to do this, and Mordechai says no, right? The interchange between Mordechai and Esther here is probably the most important that takes place in the whole book. And the entire outcome of the story turns upon this dialogue. And critically, the question will be, which we will finish discussing next week, because I want to leave you some time for questions. critically, the question will be, is the relationship between Mordechai and Esther a power relationship? And what is the significance of that? Okay, so questions. Any questions before we stop? So I'm sure there are some questions here.
Yeah, I have a question.
Sure.
I was wondering if the Midrash ever points to the idea that there were maybe lots of young Jewish women who were taken.
I mean, there might have been.
If they took married women, then
yeah, you know. We don't know. We know. I would imagine that if non-Jewish women were taken, then Jewish women were also taken. Yes, absolutely. But the Midrash doesn't mention that particularly. No.
Okay. And also, I thought, I think it was last week or maybe 2 weeks ago, you mentioned how it was 127 provinces that the Jewish reader would pick up on the connection to Sarah.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking that maybe there are more connections with Sarah also being abducted, taken to a palace.
It's deliberately referencing, definitely deliberately referencing the taking of Sarah by Paro. Yes.
And also whether the ambiguous relationship between Abraham and Sarah, sister, wife, it also reminded me like we're ambiguous.
Possibly.
Mordechai.
Yeah, they are related. Sarah is related to Abraham by any measure, not just as his wife. Any other questions, ladies, gentlemen, any other? Yeah.
Why does the Gemara assume that the antecedent of the person who was exiled is Mordechai instead of his great-grandfather Kish? It seems better to read that and historically more accurate that it was Kish that was exiled and his great, now we're talking about Mordechai, his great-grandson.
I think it could be that what the Gemara is saying is that we know that this is the case. The minute there are diaspora communities outside of Eretz Yisrael, is that Mordechai goes and exiles himself, perhaps because he believes that he is needed more there than in Eretz Yisrael. The same way that, you know, people do shlichut, or people who are in Israel people who are in Chutz Laretz, who may want to make aliyah, but they know that they have an important communal function to fulfill and they can't leave their community. So it would appear that the Gemara, at least there, seems to be implying that Mordechai chose to be the leader of the expatriate community and not to stay in Eretz Yisrael. It could be there's a sort of subtle criticism there also. It's very interesting because the Esther story, remember, is our first real diaspora text, right? It is exploring those questions of dual identity and other issues like that. Any other questions?
Yes. Could you repeat who wrote Megillat Esther?
Well, Chazal say that the authors of Megillat Esther were first and foremost Esther and Mordechai, right? Okay. In other words, Esther says, write me for the generations, right? She's the one who initiates the writing, right? She makes the demand.
Kodesh Tov to you, Simi.
Kodesh
Tov. Clothes, Yaakov and Esav. That's a person with clothes, and it says Esav, Yitzhak's Akav Dolamara, the same term.
Yes, but it's not there. When you talk about clothing with respect to Yaakov and Esav, Yaakov is quite straightforwardly disguising himself in his brother's clothing, and that's part of a larger motif of the arms of Esav and the voice of Yaakov. No, the elaborateness of the descriptions in the Yosef story and in the Purim story are what distinguish the mention of clothing here. In other words, the fact that we know the colors, the textures, the materials that are being described, that's what distinguishes it here. It's very visual, right? He's wearing white and purple and gold, right? That's the same thing with Yosef, where you get the description of what he looks like, and his brothers, in fact, don't recognize him, right? They see an Egyptian prime minister, they don't recognize the boy Yosef who left Eretz Yisrael and was sold to Egypt.
Could you address again the Ish Yemini and Ish Yehudi and how it's resolved that he's called by both those names?
Well, all Jews become Jews in exile, right? Your tribal identity, once you've been sort of lifted off your land and you no longer have your tribal portion.
So all Jews are
Jews. You know, they all look the same to me. Right. They all look alike. All Jews are Jews, right? Even though we have indications in Tanakh that that the tribes even had different dialects, right? They even had different dialects. They even had different slight differences in the way that they spoke Hebrew/Aramaic.
Shibboleth, and the left-handedless.
Yeah, no, definitely. They're definitely distinct groups, but also I'm talking about the fact that when Rav Shaket comes and the king's messenger is sitting on the top there on the wall and says, please don't speak Yehudit. Please don't speak Judean. Speak to me in your language, in Ashurit, because I don't want the people to understand. And Rav Shaket says, well, I want the people to understand. So he's speaking Yehudit. He doesn't say Ivrit, he says Yehudit, which is Judean Hebrew, or whatever the Judean dialect that had evolved. So once you're out of Eretz Yisrael, you know, Ashkenazi, Sephardi, Polish, Russian, you all look the same to me, kind of thing. And that's what Yehudi means here.
Thank you.
Okay. All right. Again, feel free to send me emails. I'll try and address the questions you raise in the next class. And we will continue with these sources next week. Please bring them. And then maybe we'll have a discussion about Haman as well. Okay? Have a great rest of the week, ladies. And gentlemen. Everybody. Okay.
Thank you.
A pleasure. Okay. Rabbi Kelman,
Thank you very much. I'll have to listen later. Thank you for the share. But last few minutes. Okay. This evening, Mark Shapiro, of course, continues his series on his book, his correspondence with the various rabbinic figures. Tomorrow, Benny Gesundheit, 12:15. There is no 11 o'clock class tomorrow. That series finished with Dr. Schwartz. That tomorrow, 12:15, Kehillim with Benny Gesundheit. And then the last of our series on Tamei Mikra with Rabbi Jeremy Weider. And I don't know if everybody got the email. I didn't send the whole list, but the people who registered for Shuli Mishkan's class, we're starting a new series Thursday on Masters of the Mishnah, her archaeology and class, basically. Fascinating class. So that's this Thursday. You can go register on the website, and we look forward to learning with you. And everybody should be well, be healthy.
Will there be classes next Monday?
Yeah, so next Monday, Malka is not giving her class. I don't know if she announced it. They should probably did. Yeah, but Simi is, I guess, because Malka lives in the United States. It's President's Day. And Simi lives in Israel, where it's Yom Sheni. So it's whatever. That's their choice. I mean, so whatever. Yeah, so next Monday, and I'm sure Mark Shapiro will give his class. I'm 98% sure. I'll confirm with Knight, but knowing the history of how we run our classes, that should be happening. So, okay. Everybody be well. I hope everybody okay. Thank you very much.
I forgot about Chodesh Tov.
Okay. Hopefully we'll see each other before Rosh Chodesh. But, okay. Thank you.
Shalom, everyone. Be well.
Be well.